The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Race and nativist fears and nativist moral panics were integrally connected. And I think Marielle and our story in many ways explores the way that happened. And we try not to be very didactic about all of that. We try to just sort of layer it in with the facts, and we explore in great detail the role of Reagan's first attorney general, William French Smith, and the way that he kind of used the language of race to characterize a fear about what open borders might mean, or what this moment in American history might mean if we didn't clamp down on the borders. And Rudy Giuliani was there as his associate attorney general. It all galvanized this kind of draconian idea of incarcerating people who come into this country as immigrants, that we would incarcerate them on arrival. If we didn't know who they were, if we didn't know where they came from, if they arrived here seeking asylum, the very first thing we do is throw them in prison. That did not exist before Marielle.
I'm Tyler McBrien, managing editor of Lawfare, and this is the Lawfare podcast, March 13th, 2023. Chip Brantley and Andrew Beck Grace are the creators of the NPR audio documentary White Lies, which was a Pulitzer finalist for its first season. Chip and Andrew are back for season two, a story they began reporting in 2015 after they stumbled on an archival photo of a prison riot in Talladega, Alabama. This season focuses on the Mario Boatlift, a six-month period in 1980 during which 125,000 Cubans emigrated to the U.S. to seek asylum. What they found is as much an American immigration story as a history of American immigration, and the laws that govern it. I sat down with Chip and Andrew to discuss the legal fictions that prop up our immigration system, how a country with due process under the law justifies detaining people indefinitely, and their obsession with Lady Bird Johnson's White House audio diaries. It's the Lawfare Podcast, March 13th. Chip Brantley and Andrew Beck Grace on White Lies, Season 2. You know, as much as I want to start with, I think, questions about your favorite road snacks and things of that nature after, you know, two seasons on the road together, I really want to start with the story itself. You know, coming off of the success of season one and a Pulitzer finalist, I may add, I'm guessing you had a lot of latitude to, you know, tell any story you wanted. So I'm curious, you know, what the story you chose to tell was and why you chose to tell it.
Yeah. Thanks for having us. It's really nice to be here. It's actually a pretty funny story about the way that this season came to be. So the first season is about the murder of Jim Reeb in Selma, Alabama in 1965, and the sort of unsolved nature of that murder and the reasons why it was unsolved for so long. And we actually started working on that story in 2015 and got to the point where we had discovered some new information about things that had happened during the investigation and really realized there was something very interesting to say about the story. And we weren't really positioned at that point. We were independent. We'd not come on board with NPR. We didn't have a relationship with a big broadcast or anything. So we weren't really positioned very well to take on what was going to be a sort of legally fraught story. And so we sort of pivoted a little bit and thought, well, let's try to figure out another story we can tell while we're nursing the Selma story along. And so we ended up sort of stumbling upon the story of this prison riot in Alabama in 1991 in Talladega. And of course, it dominoed into this much larger story about the history of immigration detention, about the Cuban Marielle Boatlift, about just all these different things. And so we actually started building out that story and actually took that to NPR to pitch them this show that we wanted to make that was going to be a serial-like, you know, seasonal show. We take a different story every year. So in the process of pitching them what ended up being our second season, we told them about this unsolved civil rights era murder that we'd been working on. So they were like, oh, we like these guys. They have a good presence and these are smart and interesting stories, but tell us more about this Selma story. And so we ended up actually pitching that kind of as our first season, and then ended up spending about a year and a half reporting that out. So in the middle of the release of the first season, the show was doing really well. NPR said they wanted a second season. And we said, well, you're in luck because we've already pitched you what we'd like to do next. So we sort of reported this story about the Talladega prison riot in 2015 and 2016, and then set it down until 2019 and 2020. And then we picked it back up again. So it was kind of a cart horse sort of thing.
We should add that the first season one of White Lies, which was, as Andy said, a civil rights cold case from 1965, it was in a lot of ways hard to report because people had died, people had forgotten things. And so when we came to this story, we foolishly said to ourselves and to our editors, this is going to be so much easier. It's set in 1980 and the 90s. There's just so much, you know, everybody's more present. It's a much simpler story to tell. And we were paid back for that naivety.
Well, I'm glad to say, and I'm sure many listeners are also glad that you were very wrong in that, and that it's quite a complex story, and because of that, it's an interesting one. And you know, as Andy, as you were saying, it's as much a story about immigration as it is an immigration story. So I want to go back to where the podcast starts and where you started, of the prison riot. You know, what sparked your initial interest in the prison riot? You know, who were the prisoners? Can you sort of lay that out? Maybe even using that archival photo that you found.
Well, yeah, it really started there. I mean, we were going through the photo archives of the Birmingham News here in Birmingham, where I live. And as we allude to in the show, the archives, it was just a bunch of mismatched filing cabinets on the third floor of the newspaper, 100 plus years of photos arranged chronologically in these little manila envelopes, the negatives were. And so you couldn't really, there was no finding aid or anything. You just sort of found the year you were interested in and started going through it. And so we were looking for something else in 1991, and came across these packets of negatives from what turned out to be August of 1991 that said, Cubans take over federal prison, Cubans take hostages, Cubans deported from Talladega. Just these, at the time, what seemed very odd headings on these middle envelopes. I should say that it's a little embarrassing now to admit that we didn't even know there was a federal prison in Talladega when we started this. It was built in the early 80s and very quickly became a holding spot for immigration detainees. And so we found these photos, we scanned them, we looked at them, and they're all pretty boring. I mean, they're just, this prison riot lasted 10 days. There were 11 hostages taken. But all that was going on the inside. And on the outside, it was just a lot of waiting. And so these photographers who took these photos from not only Birmingham News, but all over, were stationed about a quarter of a mile from the prison. The FBI and the Bureau of Prisons wanted to keep the media as far away from this as possible for reasons that we get into later in the show. But after we scanned these photos and started looking at them, really, the only ones that were at all remotely interesting were these photos of these guys who'd gone up on the roof. Some of the Cuban detainees who were being held at the prison, once the prison sort of cut the phone lines, went up on the roof with these makeshift banners to try to get the word out about what they wanted. And just looking at those photos, there was just something so strange about them that this prison riot had happened. I graduated high school. I'm going to age myself. Graduated high school in 1991, had no memory of this event, and nobody that we talked to really knew much about it or remembered much about it. And having both grown up in Alabama and seeing these photos of this prison riot and seeing these very eerie photos of these men on the roof, it just was an invitation in a way, a provocation. And so we started looking into it and very quickly realized that the story of how those men got to the roof was this sprawling sort of generational epic. They'd all come over on the Mario boat lift in 1980, which was the largest mass migration in the Western Hemisphere at the time. 125,000 people came in a matter of months on all manner of boat. And then as we began to talk to people and began to do more research, we saw what had happened to a lot of those Mariel Cubans who came. And that really is the kind of meat of the season.
Yeah. And before we rewind to the Mariel boat lift and the domino effect of immigration policies and imprisonments that happened then, I want to just dwell on the prison riot for a moment longer. Andy, I think in one of your narrations, you mentioned that this story of the prison riot, when you begin it, you know, asking around, wasn't so much a hidden history. You know, it was reported in the media at the time, but more of a forgotten history. You mentioned something about the burden of remembering. I'm curious why, you know, why you think it was forgotten, you know, over the decades.
Yeah, I mean, I actually that was just about to say something about that very thing in regards to Chip's question, and the way in which the story, when we first saw it, we were compelled by it, but pretty immediately thought, oh man, this is way too complex. Like, this is there's way too many variables. There are way too many moving parts. And I think in many ways, and in a way, this kind of like dovetails with some of the stuff that I think was happening in season one of our show too, is that sometimes we forget these stories that are instructive in certain ways about our history and about who we are as a people and about the decisions we make and the ways that our court system and our legal systems operate, partly because they get framed as being so complex. And at the end of the day, this story is actually fairly simple. You have a group of people yearning to come to this country, as people for, you know, hundreds of years now have yearned to, finding themselves as welcomed as refugees, and then pretty immediately suspected of all manner of nefarious things. And that narrative ended up shaping their experience. And so I think, you know, that complexity and the way in which that story, it was difficult at the time that we started it to know that that would actually be the benefit of the story, is the great complexity of it. But that's certainly something we felt pretty early on. And in terms of the reasons why I think it's easy to look away from something like this, is we can couch it as complexity, and that is certainly part of it. But it's also something kind of more fundamental, in that when you look at what happened to these men, it's an indirect contradiction to the sort of baseline things we say about who we are as a country, the way that we're going to welcome the stranger, that this is a nation of immigrants. These are all phrases and ideas that are familiar to us. They're also familiar, especially in the parlance of the left, as critiques of this country, because we clearly don't do this. But these are bedrock values we say we have. You know, our documents talk about all people being created equal. Obviously, that's a complicated and tricky subject when you have the men who are writing this owning enslaved people. Who are those people, right? But it doesn't say all citizens. And that's true throughout the documents. There's this kind of the sense that this country is based on this notion of deeper human rights than just citizenship and ethnicity. And yet in this case, because these people were non-citizens, we essentially deemed them to have no rights, that their rights didn't matter, that their inborn human rights that the documents celebrate were not actually, they weren't meaningful to us. In fact, the very famous line from the Ignaz Mazet Supreme Court ruling is that this citizen, Ignaz Mazet, this Romanian who'd come to this country, found himself detained in immigration detention because they didn't want to accept him into the country, and no other nation would take him. And the ruling there says that this man is no more ours than theirs. In other words, we have no responsibility for him. And I think that's in pretty direct contradiction to the way that a lot of people in this country like to imagine who we are. So I think those are the reasons why it was easy to forget something like this. And honestly, pretty easy to look away. I mean, when you hear this notion of kids in cages, like, I find myself wanting to look away from that too. It's a very, very overwhelming thing. And then you say, well, immigration's complex because we have to have controls, and what is a nation and what is a border, and all that stuff just gets real gray real quick. And I feel like one of the virtues of trying to tell the story in the way that we've tried to tell the story is we're trying to strip away some of that artifice, some of that sort of complexity, by getting really deeply into what exactly happened in the situation. And once you see that, these justifications for who we are as a people, they sort of fade away to some degree. And then they make us question ourselves in a much deeper, more profound level. At least I hope. I mean, that's the point of the work we do. So,
yeah, I think you're touching on one of the strongest themes that came through to me when I was listening, this distinction between history and theater. Chip, I wonder if you could touch on that. I think this came through again and again, you know, where history and theater either do overlap in some cases, and then many times when they're at odds with each other.
Yeah, I mean, we've now decided if we get to do this again, we have to do a story that can have Lady Bird Johnson archival audio in it, because we've now done that for two seasons and we couldn't do it any other way at this point.
Yeah, it's a trope. It's the Lady Bird Johnson launches you on a quest trope, you know.
That's right. Yeah, so that distinction between theater and history we introduce in the first episode, and it is a line from Lady Bird Johnson's audio diary that she kept throughout LBJ's presidency. And this was, she's describing when she says her actual line, it was good history and it was good theater. I can't do a Lady Bird Johnson accent, but it was good history and it was good theater.
That's pretty good.
I've heard it enough. It should just be in my brain, ready to play at a moment's notice. But she's referring to the signing of the Immigration Act of 1965, which LBJ signed at the base of the Statue of Liberty. In October, is that right, Andy? October 1965?
Yeah, I don't remember the month.
And he had his favorite opera singer, whose name I've forgotten, sing, I think it was America the Beautiful.
Yeah,
we tried very hard to find archival of that and could not find it. But she says of that moment, of the signing of the Immigration Act of 1965, which was at that point the most progressive, one might argue the only progressive immigration act in the country's history, which really radically sort of shifted the demographics of this country over the next 40, 50 years. She said of it, it was good history, and just the moment itself was good theater. Signing it onto the base of the Statue of Liberty, invoking the words there at the Statue of Liberty. And that, when we heard that, really felt like that is the theme for this season, this distinction and this tension between the theater on the one hand, the story we tell about who we are, and the history, what actually happened. And as we explore in the show, sometimes those overlap, sometimes they align. And that moment in 1965 was one of those. It was one of those times that it felt like it was aligning. And there were moments of beats in our story, parts of the Morial boat lift, where it feels like we are trying to live up to the story we tell about ourselves, that we welcome the stranger, that we're a country of immigrants. But as we dig into, as the show goes on, that was a moment. And then this story that we're exploring, the theater and the history began to diverge again. And the theater of that this would be this sort of, great welcoming of all these refugees really was overtaken pretty quickly by a darker narrative about who these people were, that they were communists, that they were black and brown people, that they were here to sort of take something from us, from mainstream American society. All that began to really overtake the narrative of the boat lift and really shifted. And as Andy mentioned just a minute ago, that story began to trap these Morial excludables, these men who would struggle for the next decade to find freedom.
Yeah. Let's talk about that fairly rapid narrative shift from, as you tell it, at the beginning of the Morial boat lift, it was really, thought of as this sort of freedom flotilla of, Cubans seeking freedom in the United States, but quickly shifted, as you said, into something darker. So, what do you attribute to that, quick shift that really, as you said, trapped the Morialitos from that point forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a kind of a combination of things, and a lot of it has to do with the press, frankly. I mean, I think one of the things we have been really interested in our work through these two seasons, and also just thinking about future stories that we want to tell. And I think it maybe just comes from our just interest as journalists too, is the role that the media has in shaping perception in so many ways, especially as an event is unfolding. And what happened initially is this, this is an anti-communist moment, right? And in a very anti-communist period in our history in the Cold War. And the idea that these Cuban Americans would come down to Mariel and pull these people out of communism was a really incredible galvanizing moment for the country, and especially for the Cuban exile community in Miami. In fact, I think it was the largest demonstrations in Miami's history were pro-Mariel demonstrations and food drives and all kinds of stuff that was happening in the early days of the boat lift. And then I think what happened is, it's a kind of, I'm going to critique exile Cubans and Mariel, so I've got to be careful here about the way that I phrase this, but I think it's backed up in a lot of the research and conversations we've had with lots and lots of folks in Miami, is that there was this sort of tenuous hold on nascent political power in Miami from now Cuban Americans, the first generation, first wave Cubans. And when they started seeing who was actually coming over, that first wave of Cubans that came after the revolution were largely well-educated. A lot of them had money. A lot of them were aligned with American business interests. There were all kinds of people who came, but the majority of them were considered white as they arrived into this country. I mean, they were considered Cuban first. That's what they would tell you, and they're right about that. But they were light-skinned. They were sort of ushered into whiteness. Michael Bustamante, this historian at the University of Miami, who's himself Cuban-American, has written about this extensively, that they were kind of funneled into what at that time was the sort of segregation academies of Miami, that as a city was kind of coming out of segregation, Cubans found themselves being identified as white and galvanizing that sort of political power and that sort of cultural power that whiteness has in a place like this country. And so I think when there was an initial excitement about bringing out the Cubans from communist Cuba, but then when you have 20-year-olds, single men, many of them Afro-Cuban, there's estimates that around a third of the boat lift were Afro-Cuban, dark skin, not educated. And then one of the things that I think is really distinct about the group of Mariel Cubans is that they had grown up underneath the communist regime. They had grown up in Castro's Cuba. They had not grown up in capitalist Cuba. And so there's a kind of ideological difference between the people who are coming. And then the biggest sort of death knell for the Freedom Flotilla narrative is the story that Castro had emptied his jails and this is the words that get used over and over again, Castro had emptied his jails and emptied his mental institutions. That phrasing and that idea, and then the proof, the reality that in some of the early days of the boat lift, Castro did seed some of these ships with lots of folks who were coming from prisons. Most of them were low-level offenders. There were a lot of political prisoners, but there was no doubt. And they said as they arrived on the docks, yes, I came from a Cuban prison. I was in jail for stealing, or I was in jail because of my political activity, or I refused to join the military. But in many cases, that was enough, you know, for that perception and those optics to galvanize around this changing narrative that these were not people we wanted to welcome into this country. And the sort of communist, you know, veneer fell away from them. And instead they became criminal aliens as opposed to, you know, refugees seeking freedom, I think is one of the ways we talk about it on the show. And so I think the media played into that a lot. In fact, there's a New York Times story the day that this large ship, the America, arrives, which is something we talk about. The America had been basically hired by a few hundred, I think, Cuban Americans to bring back 600 or so Cuban relatives. There was not a single relative on that boat. It was all people that the Cuban government had put aboard. Many of them were suspected mental patients and people from prisons. The reality is likely that many of them were low-level offenders, or they were people that were in detention in Cuba for vagrancy or whatever it might be. But these were not desirable people in the sort of common sense. So I think even that moment and when that happens, the New York Times headline is, I mean, it's not a headline you could get away with today, but it talks about the retarded people being put on the boats. And that's on the front page of the New York Times. And I think there's a real shift that happens at that particular moment. And then, you know, we talk about this in the show, but later on, sociologists and media critics have sort of studied the way that the story gets told, and the negative coverage in the Miami Herald in particular of the Mariel Cubans. It flips almost overnight. And all of a sudden, Mariel is a problem. Even before Mariel becomes a problem, Mariel is being characterized as a problem.
And then for years, we talked to one reporter, Fabiola Santiago, who told us that for years, anytime anyone associated with Mariel committed a crime of any sort, they would refer to him in the paper as a Mariel criminal or a Mariel Cuban, where they didn't really do that for other groups. You know, as she said, we didn't do that for people from Ohio, for example. And as Andy alluded to, the people who've studied the number of serious criminals who may have come over in Mariel, it's a really small percentage of the overall boat lift population. But in the collective imagination, that was a boat lift filled entirely with criminals. We had one interviewed a man who worked at a refugee resettlement camp, who described it perfectly when he said that they were sent here with a label and we accepted that label. And really, once that label was affixed to these guys, pretty much everything that happened from then on was just this sort of vicious loop where they were perceived this way. Therefore, it became harder for them to find sponsors. The fact that they couldn't find sponsors just hardened the image of them as people who weren't worthy of sponsoring. And it just, that loop just kept going until they, you know, had been detained for a long time.
Yeah, I think one of the more disturbing things I remember listening is I think a perfect illustration of what we're talking about here of, you know, this perception of the right kind of refugee or immigrant, i.e. white, when I think it was an INS, person at INS was receiving sponsor requests from people who wanted, you know, educated white refugees who speak English. And the INS person, you know, basically was like, this is not a serious catalog for refugees. You know, I want to trace now the fate of the Mariel refugees or rather asylum seekers, as the distinction is made clear later on from...
Thank you for recognizing that.
Yeah. Well, you know, actually, this might be a good time to talk about that. I think one of the really interesting legal questions here was, you know, the importance of labels of, you know, refugee versus asylum seeker, especially with the, I think, uncannily timed Refugee Act that came out a few weeks before. So could you actually talk about that distinction?
Yeah. I've had a few semesters of imaginary law school, and a few of those courses were in imaginary law of immigration history. So I'm going to speak with a little bit of imaginary experience here.
We fought really hard for that imaginary law to be in the show too. And so it's gratifying to hear you just drop in the distinction between asylum seeker and refugee.
And right. I've seen your imaginary JD, and for all the listeners, it's very real and very imaginary.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Every time we'd be on with one of NPR's lawyers and talking about some issue of fair use, I would always have to, and my father's an attorney. It's a bad habit I have, but it turns out that when you work on a story like this, you end up spending a ton of time reading legal review articles and diving into the history of how we have thought about immigration in this country. And it's really actually pretty fascinating. And you're right that it is an incredible coincidence that in 1980, because of the priorities of the Carter administration, they completely revamped the way that they imagined how we would welcome refugees into this country. But that imagining had nothing to do with something like the boat lift or even the southern border, for that matter. It had everything to do with sort of Cold War, communist country kind of priority, and also the notion of refugee camps far away from this country where people would be processed, and then we could bring them in a sort of quota system of however many people from that country we wanted to bring in. Whatever year. In fact, I think it was an annual reallotment of whatever number from whatever country. So it had in no way envisioned something like Mariel happening. And I think the distinction of why these folks were treated initially as refugees or thought to be refugees by the media and by Cuban Americans, certainly in Miami, and then pretty quickly deemed to be something different, has everything to do with the nature of their arrival. And also something that our story does not spend a lot of time talking about and thinking about, because it's a little bit off the axis of, you know, we come back, we even say in the show at one point that it's the indefinite detention, stupid. Like, this idea that galvanized us to want to tell the story in the first place is the fact that because of all the things that we go into in the show, we essentially took a group of non-citizens and said, because we can't send them back, we can indefinitely detain them without a charge for year after year after year. And that is so shocking on a sort of central sort of who we are as a country level that has become the lodestar for us. And so we've oriented a lot of the storytelling around that. And because of that, we've had to sort of leave certain very, very interesting elements out. But because we're talking about the show, I'll tell you this one particular interesting element, which is the concurrence of the Haitian migrants while Mariel was unfolding. It has a lot to do with why the Cubans were treated the way they were, because there was all of a sudden this terrifying reality to certain political forces in this country, and also just to the notion of having borders and having some control over that, that in a place like Florida in particular, you could have people from island nations show up. And if your refugee laws allowed for that, there would be no quota system. We would just have to take these folks in. And the wet foot, dry foot policy, which Obama did away with, had really allowed that for Cubans. But the sheer number of arrivals, mostly from Cuba, but concurrent arrivals from Haiti, made them feel like we have got to change this designation. We cannot just allow all these people in as refugees. So the actual legal definition of who they were was Cuban Haitian entrant status pending. It's like the longest immigration designation ever. And it was only for this period of whatever it was, 4.5 months or so. There's a very specific start date and a very specific end date. And if you arrived via the ocean during that time from one of those two nations, that's who you were. You were not a refugee. And in certain ways, you weren't even really properly an asylum seeker. You were an entrant who had come to this country without permission. And now we were going to determine your status. And that could be through asylum claims. Many people tried to take advantage of the Refugee Act unsuccessfully. And so there's just such a complex legal history to what was happening at the time with our immigration policies. It's very fascinating. And again, my imaginary law degree is coming in handy here as I talk about it. But we talked to so many great immigration attorneys about all of this, and it really is fascinating.
Well, and that entrance status, the big consequence of that new status too, meant that you weren't legally seen to be in the country. You were you were an entrant. You were at the border basically asking to come in, legally speaking. So as we explore, and I'm sure we'll talk about, that entrance status meant that you were not set foot in the country legally, even though you, of course, were in the country.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. I want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before DeleteMe started advertising with Lawfare. DeleteMe finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then DeleteMe comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. DeleteMe sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20
and use promo code LAWFARE20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
Yeah, it seems like a great place to talk about, you know, actually, this is one of my favorite legal concepts, and that of the legal fiction. And so, as you were just sort of hinting at, is the idea of the entry fiction, which is the name of one of your episodes. So can you, just for the listener, what is the entry fiction? How does it fit into this story? And then maybe a little bit about the story of Ignaz Mazet.
Yeah. So the entry fiction is a very understandable framework. It's a legal fiction, which, again, going back to my training here, but the legal fiction idea is that we have to construct something that on the face of it seems untrue and is untrue simply to kind of articulate a principle of the law. And that's probably a pretty inarticulate way to say it. But in this case, you have, let's take Ellis Island, early 20th century as an example, because this is where it originates. You have people arriving on a ship. You have INS agents who want to ask these people about their backgrounds, where they're coming from, what country they're coming from because of certain quotas and things of that nature, what their history is. Are they fleeing persecution of some sort? Are they political refugees? Were they, there's all manner of questions that the immigration service might want to ask a potential entrant into the country. And during that time that those interviews are taking place, initially those interviews took place on ships, literally on the ship. The immigration agents would go onto the ship. And as the ships got larger and as more people came in the late 19th, early 20th century, there's so many people coming, they kind of allow for there to be this temporary removal. And so you go into this holding place, Ellis Island was a common one, where you are interviewed. But while you're there, you're not seen to be in the country. You're seen to be still, legally speaking, the fiction is that you're on the boat, but you're not on the boat. You're on the land, but the legal fiction is you're still on the boat. And during that that determining time, you're not in the country. And they're telling you you're on the boat, but you're actually in the country. So what is fascinating about what happens with these Mariel Cubans is that 125,000 people come to this country from Cuba, and they're all said to be floating off the coast while we decide whether or not we're going to let them in. So they use immigration parole. It was the first big place where immigration parole was used. It had been used in the 50s. It had existed for a long time for smaller groups of people, but it had never been used on this scale. And it wasn't really designed. This is why they created this sort of Cuban-Haitian entrant status pending designation, because it was a way to kind of codify what parole for this specific group of people looked like. It's a fascinating distinction, and it really imperils these folks, because that parole into the country isn't a criminal parole. They haven't committed a crime by which they are now being monitored or anything like that. We are making a determination about whether or not we're going to take this person into the country. So the minute they run afoul of the law in any way, that can be an opportunity for revocation for parole. And what I mean by that is that's an opportunity for the American government to say, all right, you asked to come in and now we're saying no, and now we're going to send you back. But in the case of these Cubans, they could not send them back, which is one of the distinctions that makes our story about these Cubans different than the Haitians. The Haitians could be sent back. I mean, there's lots to say about how problematic that was. But with the Cubans, when they said, we want to send you back, they had nowhere to go except for these federal prisons throughout the country, where they were detained in some hope that at maybe some point in the future, there would be some remedy. But in the meantime, they were languishing without any sort of legal rights, without any constitutional protections, without any due process. A lot of volunteer attorneys came out of the woodwork to essentially advocate for these folks. But it was all outside the bounds of a normal criminal proceeding, because they were not seen to have any legal rights at all to be in the country.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest questions that I think anyone who's listening to this would have is, in a country with due process under the law, how can indefinite detention like this occur? So I'm curious, maybe Chip, if you can think of any of the other legal justifications that were used, to perpetuate this indefinite detention stupid. I'm not calling you stupid.
Well, Andy does all the time, so it's you can too. So.
True.
I haven't built up that rapport yet, but hopefully by the end of this. And then maybe also on the flip side, as you mentioned, some of these really incredible stories of volunteer attorneys and legal aid organizations coming out of the woodwork to use some really creative, counter justifications to actually get some of these people out of the prisons.
Yeah, I mean the basic law that was used to justify this entry fiction, as it was called, that these Cubans weren't here, and therefore, since they're not on U.S. soil, they don't have right to due process. They have no constitutional rights. It is as if they are not here, as if they're floating off the coast asking to come in. Was this mid-1950s Supreme Court case involving a man, Ignaz Vaze, who Andy mentioned earlier, who was Romanian, who'd come to this country in 1923, settled in Buffalo, New York, got married to an American citizen, became stepfather to her three children. And in the 40s, Mazze found out that his mother was dying back in Romania and tried to go back to care for her. Made it as far as Hungary before he found out his mother died, and so then began the process of trying to come back to the United States. But in the 25 years that he had been in the United States, Ignaz Mazze had not become a U.S. citizen. And so when he returned in a very, very different scenario, 1923 versus the late 40s, early 50s, when, of course, the Cold War has set in. There is anti-communist fervor in the United States, and he has just been going back basically close to, if not behind, the Iron Curtain. And so he's suspected of being a communist or a communist sympathizer. U.S. immigration authorities, when he comes back to the country, deny him entry. Even though he has his life back in Buffalo, they say no. And because he is not a citizen, and he's basically asking to come into the country, he's detained at Ellis Island. His home country, Romania, won't take him back. He tries to go to other countries that won't take him back. And so he basically languishes at Ellis Island. He's detained there for years, sues the federal government many times. Finally, the U.S. Supreme Court in, I believe, 1953.
I think that's right.
53, 54, makes a ruling saying that the U.S. can detain a non-citizen. And not only can it detain a non-citizen, it can detain a non-citizen indefinitely, and that non-citizen really has no recourse to challenge that detention. So basically, not only can you be detained, you can be detained indefinitely, and there's no real way to challenge it. You have no process through which you can challenge that detention. So as soon as Mariel starts happening, as soon as these rumors about who is being sent from Cuba, and as soon as the narrative of the boat lift is changing, U.S. Immigration officials and DOJ officials start crafting basically a legal argument that is based on Mazze, that these people are not in the country. They are entrants asking to come in. Therefore, they can be detained while we figure out what to do with them and try to work to send them back. And as Andy said, because the U.S. and Cuba had no migration agreement at the time and weren't really even speaking officially diplomatically, even though there were low-level talks going on all the time, there was no process to send these guys back, the people that they wanted to send back. And so the U.S. basically crafted this argument that they would maintain for years that these people were not in the country, therefore they had no due process. And so, you know, if you think this is happening in 1980, a couple of months, that's, you know, someone being detained without cause, that goes, you know, in the end of 1980, now it's 6 months, and then going into 1981, now it's been a year. The time just is creeping by, basically. And these people were, you know, when the Mariel Cubans came into the country, they had some immigration interviews done in Florida, but very quickly realized they couldn't manage it all there. So they sent them to refugee resettlement camps scattered around the country, with the main one being in Fort Chaffee, Arkansas. And as those immigration interviews happened, certain people would be, for all sorts of reasons that we explore in the show, maybe they would admit to having been in a Cuban prison for something. Maybe someone would, another Mariel refugee would basically rattle them and say that they were a serious criminal. Could be anything, really. They could be detained at a federal prison. So they sent them to Talladega, Alabama. They sent them to Leavenworth, to Terre Haute. They sent them to the federal prison in Atlanta, Georgia. And so by 1981, the federal prison in Atlanta, Georgia, which had been scheduled to close the year before, had become the main holding pen for these immigration detainees. And basically, because these guys had no real constituency, they were outside of Miami, as Andy talked about earlier, sort of Miami Cubans. Initially, the established Cuban community in Miami had kind of turned on these guys. They just had no real advocates. But they happened to be in Atlanta, and very quickly in 1981, the Atlanta Legal Aid Society kind of came to their defense and would basically be by their side for the next 10 years.
Yeah, I just want to go back to Mazze for just a second, because it's worth thinking about, and then we should definitely talk more about the Atlanta Legal Aid Society and their work and the judge in that, in those cases, Judge Shube. But the Mazet, there's one thing that there's so much information you learn when you're reporting on a story like this, and there's so much that gets left on the cutting room floor. And one of the heartbreaks for me was not being able to talk more about this incredible dissent in the Mazet case from Justice Robert Jackson, who has maybe some of the most beautiful language of any Supreme Court ruling I've ever read. Well, a dissent in this case. And he says of Mazet, I've just pulled it up because I want to make sure I get it right. Since we proclaim him a Samson who might pull down the pillars of our temple, we should not be surprised if peoples less prosperous, less strongly established, and less stable feared to take him off our timorous hands. And then he has what gets quoted, I think, in lots of writing about great, beautiful writing within the law. Government counsel ingeniously argued that Ellis Island is his refuge, whence he is free to take leave in any direction except west. That might mean freedom if only he were an amphibian. It's just beautiful writing, you know, this idea that he can go anywhere just if he could swim, you know. And really the reason why Justice Jackson writes the way he does is because he understands that the law actually allows our country to do this. So he's less arguing on the merits of the law and is arguing instead against the majority by saying, we are not these people. We should not be these people. And we are, in this case, being these people, people that we say we're not going to be. So for those of you who might be interested in immigration law who haven't read this dissent, I highly recommend it.
Well, and it's the other thing to say about Mazet too is that, I mean, I think 2A1, people we've talked to who have studied the implications of it, think of it as just a terrible decision. I mean, it was a 5-4 decision, but it's still, I don't know that we talked to anyone who remains in favor of that decision. But
I'm pretty sure the government's attorney who argued against the Mariel Cuban remains in favor.
I don't know that he was in favor of it. He just was thankful that he had it.
Exactly.
But who was Jackson's law clerk at the time?
Oh, it was Rehnquist, I think.
Rehnquist, yeah. Who disagreed with him, right?
I believe so, yeah. I need to fact check that. But
This is the nerdy legal history that the listeners want. This is great. No, that's a beautiful passage. I was thinking if I were your editor, I would have forced you to put that in because that's great. And then I will say, fortunately, something that did make it in it was I grew up in the suburbs of Atlanta, and the sort of mini history of the Atlanta penitentiary was just fascinating. I won't go too far into it, but it was definitely, you know, for anyone interested in Atlanta history, that was a great part. I want to just go back also to what you mentioned of, you know, some of the efforts of Judge Shube to undo some of the harmful effects of the Mazet ruling that, you know, he was then, you know, I think, overruled, you know, on appeal, but, you know, some of his arguments. And then also, if you could talk about, you know, I really like the distinction you made between sort of the interpretation of the law versus following the law and, you know, his idea of that.
Yeah, I mean, it really goes back to Justice Jackson. Same thing. It's like one of the questions that the law has to address for us is the degree to which we only follow what the letter says, or the degree to which we follow bigger principles that are embedded within the documents. And I think, for my money, and I guess I'm just a diehard sort of civil libertarian in this regard, the documents are the guiding force. And when the government, in particular, argues, well, yes, but you see, we have connected this perplexing and peculiar precedent with this perplexing and peculiar precedent to arrive at a decision which strips people of their fundamental rights. And therefore, it's okay because I can make the steps back to how the law allows us to do that. And I think that's what Judge Shube saw as well in the Northern District of Georgia, that the government's attorneys, the attorneys for the Justice Department, we're making this argument based on Mazet. And when he looks at Mazet, he says, well, but this is, Mazet was decided improperly. This should not be allowed to happen in this country. And he has a great line in his first big ruling in favor of these Mariel Cubans, because the Justice Department has essentially said to him, you actually don't have authority here because of the doctrine of plenary power. It's the federal government who gets to make these decisions. The fact that you're even hearing a habeas corpus case about the detention of some of these Mariel Cubans is an anomaly. You shouldn't have taken it. You don't have jurisdiction. You shouldn't be making this decision at all. And so he writes in his decision, is it my court's responsibility to make this decision? We have decided that it is. I mean, he essentially takes their challenge at face value and says, I'm ordering this man released because I think it is my right and I think it is what this court is established for. The 11th Circuit disagreed with him. And another thing on the cutting room floor, but might be of interest to your audience is the degree to which or how contentious that got between the 11th Circuit and Judge Shube and his clerks. It became very personal. And it's still, I think, from all the folks we talked to, Judge Shube is deceased. The folks on the 11th Circuit, the judges who made those decisions, are also deceased. So we can't really get the direct back and forth between those folks anymore. But from the clerk's perspective and the folks who were in the courtroom at the time, it became particularly personal in a way that I think has been frustrating for those in the Atlanta legal community who were in favor of the rights of these guys, that you could have this established, respected judge be so thoroughly, not really humiliated, because from an intellectual standpoint, he was never humiliated, but the 11th Circuit constantly telling him he had no right to make these rulings. One of the justices on the 11th Circuit told an attorney for the Cubans that we can keep these people in jail until they die. And at some point, one of the folks from the Justice Department, I think it may have been Rudy Giuliani, you know, made this kind of almost threatening phone call to Shube saying, you have got to step away from these. You cannot be ruling on this anymore. We have the things that we want to do at the federal level, and it's not your responsibility. And it, you know, there's still, I think, some schisms in the Atlanta legal community because of that.
Yeah, he, you know, it's interesting about those Shube's first orders. And so what they found, so all these, I can't remember the exact numbers, but that, you know, in the thousands of Mariel Cubans were being detained in Atlanta as of, let's say, the middle of 1981. And every imaginable case that you can come up with for who these guys were there. Like, there were all sorts of scenarios. And so the Atlanta legal aid attorneys who started trying to work on their behalf just couldn't handle it all. I mean, there were no immigration judges in Atlanta at the time, so they were at the mercy of immigration judges from around the country cycling through for little stints there. And most of the Mariel Cubans came with very little in the way of documentation. And so getting an actual story about what had happened to these guys in Cuba, what they may have done or not done, was virtually impossible. But very quickly, what the INS and what the DOJ claimed was that the government had the right to detain these guys solely for lacking entry papers, which no Mariel Cuban had, zero, none of the 130,000, I should say none, if any, very few of the 130,000, 125,000 to 130,000 Mariel Cubans had entry papers, had proper documentation to enter the country. And so on that standard, all of them were able to be detained indefinitely for lacking entry papers. And so Judge Shube very quickly, I think, even though the Mazet precedent said that the government did in fact have the right to detain any of these people indefinitely and give them no recourse to challenge their detention, very quickly, as Andy said, realized that that was not fair, it wasn't reasonable, it wasn't humane, and so sort of made, I think, a distinction there between simply following the Mazet precedent versus interpreting the law in a way that spoke to the documents and spoke to the ideals expressed in the documents.
You know, as I was listening, I think I was having a lot of feelings of deja vu, perhaps. So I'm curious, you know, what, you know, to the extent to which we can trace some of the roots of today's immigration policy challenges to the Mariel episode and some of the other episodes that you've successfully woven throughout. Yeah, what lessons do you have for today from this story?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think... Well, I know we didn't know. This is what's so incredible about the work we get to do is that we had a kind of initial, I would think of it kind of in a way as a mystery. And we certainly, from a narrative standpoint, try to frame it that way. But it was a series of questions and a series of confusions, frankly, when we heard about this story and learned about the contours of its broader history. And so I think we set out wanting to understand that stuff better. So we didn't set out knowing that what we were going to find would help explain the situation we find ourselves in today, but damn if it didn't do that. I mean, we in going and exploring what happened during Mariel and the way that our immigration law was essentially utilized the public perception of Mariel to recreate, I should say, but on a scale unimaginable before then, the notion of immigration detention was really fascinating. I mean, the Reagan administration's lawyers, really not Reagan himself, who was, as I'm sure listeners know, pretty pretty in favor of a more sensible and humane kind of immigration policy, and ironically, very, very sensible toward Cuba because of his sort of general longstanding anti-communist perception there of we should welcome any Cuban that wants to come here. But this perception in across the country that the media perpetuated about who the Mariel Cubans were created a moment where we could detain these people with the idea that they were criminals and that we didn't even really need to interrogate that question too much. We could just put them in jail. And there's a great, there's a historian who wrote a great book called Forever Prisons. His name's Elliot Young, about the sort of creation of the immigration detention empire. And as I talked to him about, he's not in the show, but did a, you know, had a long conversation with him after I read his book. And one of the things that he said that really was very interesting to us is that, you know, the laws existed, the ability to detain non-citizens who came to this country asking for some sort of entry that had existed for a very long time. But Mariel provided the optics to allow the creation of the sort of system that we have, that we now have in this country, where we detain more immigrants than any other nation at any point in history. I mean, we have an immigration detention system, which is, I think, very familiar to most Americans, unlike it was maybe even 10 years ago. And so I think the roots of that system come out of Mariel in many ways, and come out of the intersecting policies and realization, really, that race and nativist fears and nativist moral panics were integrally connected. And I think Mariel and our story in many ways explores the way that happened. And we try not to be very didactic about all of that. We try to just sort of layer it in with the facts, and we explore in great detail the role of Reagan's first attorney general, William French Smith, and the way that he kind of used the language of race to characterize a fear about what open borders might mean, or what this moment in American history might mean if we didn't clamp down on the borders. And Rudy Giuliani was there as his associate attorney general. It all galvanized this kind of draconian idea of incarcerating people who come into this country as immigrants, that we would incarcerate them on arrival. If we didn't know who they were, if we didn't know where they came from, if they arrived here seeking asylum, the very first thing we do is throw them in prison. That did not exist before Mariel, and it exists as a result of Mariel.
Yeah, I think, as you well pointed out, many of the aspects of the system can be traced to this episode, but also many people. I was really surprised the extent to which so many familiar characters of the 90s, early 2000s, even through today, kept coming up, like Rudy Giuliani, Bill Clinton, Bill Barr. It was almost like a Forrest Gump situation where, you know, American players touched this.
Well, and we could go deeper too. Unfortunately, we didn't get there's John Roberts was a young attorney in Reagan's in the White House at the time, and John Bolton has some rulings about this. I mean, Giuliani was really the one where we were like, oh my goodness, we've got this Giuliani stuff. Partly because he's one of the few that actually made public comments about it. That when you're making radio, it's very helpful to have people speaking, especially with a recognizable voice like Giuliani's.
Well, and he was the point person. I mean, he was the attack dog too for the government when it came to the Mariel Cubans.
Yeah, and I'm curious, you know, if there's anything else you wanted to talk about that was left on the cutting room floor. There was already some great nuggets you mentioned, but anything else you wished you could have shoehorned in?
I think, you know, as much as we can trace the roots of today to Mariel in a lot of ways, I think one of the things that we at least start off doing and you know, allude to throughout, but maybe didn't land as much as we wanted to, was just how this was in a lot of ways a you know, a newer manifestation of an old American sin. Like, this was, Mariel gave the government the tools to create the system, but they did it by tapping into some long simmering sentiments in this country. And I think we allude to that in the first episode, and I think that's just an abiding interest of ours, regardless of the story.
Yeah, one quote I wrote down was that you referred to this as, you know, the easiest and oldest kind of American theater, and I think that really came through.
Yeah, it's definitely the thread that I think connects the seasons, and also the story that we're really interested in continuing to pursue is the way in which our history is oftentimes at odds with the story we like to tell about who we are as a people.
Tyler, you'll have to apologize to Benjamin that we didn't work in the phrase plenary authority or plenary power. We felt shamed that we were going to come back on Lawfare not having worked in the phrase plenary power into the show. It's a real failing.
I was giving you the chance to work it in this episode, which you did. So you're forgiven in your Lawfare sins.
That's great. Next time we'll choose a plenary power centric story and make sure we never deviate from it, you know.
Perfect. Well, as long as it has Lady Bird Johnson in there, then you're fine.
That's right. This really narrows the search. Yeah.
That's how we find stories now. We just listen day after day to her audio diaries and look for hints.
Next season's going to be about wildflowers.
Yeah. The interstates.
I'm actually curious, and this is just for me, actually, you know, how you stumbled upon her audio diaries, or, you know, where you heard of them, or how you even knew to look for them.
Yeah, they're on the LBJ website, the library's website, and they're all there, and they're in the public domain, as you know, most of these documents were created in the federal government are. I think our first season, we came across a recording of hers the night that Jim Reeb died, because one of the things that's interesting in the first season is that, you know, this man, this white minister from Boston, comes down to Selma to participate in the Voting Rights Act movement. And he's only there less than 24 hours. He's attacked by these other white men on the street corner, and he ends up dying a few days later. And LBJ mentions him, not by name, but he says a good man, you know, has died in Selma as a result of the protest marches that were happening in Selma at the time. And so the invocation of his name was a big sort of point for us as we tried to explain to the listener why it would be important to try to solve the murder of what happened to him. And I think it was just in some research we were doing about that day and those moments in the White House. There's actually some really incredible stuff about that speech. Anyway, lots of stuff off the axis of our story, but because it's audio and we found this audio diary, and actually there's a line that she says that Lady Bird says, and she's characterizing, I'm going into too much detail here, but you asked and I love this story, so I'm going to tell you the whole thing, which is that, you know, before the speech, before he went to give the speech, there were all these protesters on the streets out, you know, throughout the whole Capitol, in the White House itself.
Yeah, on the White House lawn, yeah.
Right. And then after the speech, they return and the protesters have really thinned out. There was something about his speech that really made people who were advocating for civil rights believe that he might actually do something. And in fact, he did. He passed the Voting Rights Act. In her telling of that night, she's talking about this sort of cacophony of voices and just the chaos of the White House. And she says, what a house, what a life. And we've always loved that idea to characterize, I mean, the pleasure it is for us as reporters, but also just that these cataclysmic moments in American history. And so, you know, when we realized that the 1965 Voting Rights Act was going to be a central sort of launching point for the show to discuss the real changes that I think are happening in the middle of the 20th century as it relates to telling a new story about who we might be. And the Voting Rights Act is absolutely a part of the progressive agenda of the Johnson years. You know, of course, we're going back through the archives again, going back through the LBJ Library website. And then I think one of us just had the idea to sort of, I wonder if Lady Bird had anything to say about that. And sure enough, she'd gone to the Statue of Liberty and has this great thing. And it was just in listening to that, she said this idea of the theater and the history. And so there again, Lady Bird is giving us these nuggets that really end up imbuing our stories with some meaning. So we're two for two. We'll see if she keeps going in the third season.
Well, we roughly began with Lady Bird, so it seems fitting that we should end with Lady Bird. So Andy and Chip, I really want to thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, thank it's you, been Tom. Great.
Pleasure.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcast. Look out for other shows, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th. Check out our written work at lawfareblog.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer this episode is Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.